Today is May 16th, 2018, and this is episode number 462 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, part-time kitten wrangler and sometimes kitten platform. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on a question, anything about the show, shoot us a note at facebook.com/groups/contextmachine.
You know, I think, Brian, at some point, we're all kitten wranglers and we're all kitten platforms.
This is probably true. I am particularly adept in wrangling kittens.
This is a good life skill to have.
It is an excellent. I found that it has been a very, very, very good life skill to have. I'm not sure that I've achieved full and complete success in wrangling kittens. At least I haven't necessarily met all of my kitten wrangling goals. But I've been very good at it so far.
See, you're a competent and well-versed kitten wrangler.
Yeah, I'm probably a little better than that, yeah. I just, you know, I still have some goals I'd like to achieve.
That's okay. Goals are important.
Fair points. Fair points all around. So let's see here. Let's start off with the, not quite breaking news, but new news.
Okay.
The Senate, that'd be the U.S. Senate, the upper chamber in the Congress here in these United States.
Near the left ventricle. Wrong kind of chamber. Carry on.
Kind of chamber. Yes. Passed legislation to establish that would block Ajit Pai from and the FCC from dismantling net neutrality rules.
Yes, finally.
Well, you say that.
Oh, I know. There are still hurdles, but I really like that the Senate went ahead and used the authority that Congress has to question and potentially overturn something that the FCC has done. In this case, deciding that we don't need net neutrality.
To be fair, there are people who have argued all along that Congress should have done this instead of the SEC originally. So in 2015, Tom Wheeler's FCC, Tom Wheeler was chairman at the time, they reclassified ISPs under Title II, right?
Yes.
Basically making them common carriers.
Common carriers.
And which, among other things, allow the FCC from imposing net neutrality rules. Well, after the reclassification under Title II, the FCC imposed net neutrality as an issue of a codified regulation as opposed to a principle that everybody was heretofore honoring in principle. Except for when they didn't,
which happens surprisingly often.
Well, so that's I want to jump ahead to that point.
Okay.
I heard this. Did you watch that Intelligence Squared debate that I linked to a couple weeks ago?
Maybe. That was a couple weeks ago. I don't remember what I had for lunch.
Well, it was a good couple hours. So, you know.
Oh, then no, I didn't watch it. I probably thought, that's a couple hours.
Have you ever listened to Intelligence Squared or watched it? It's on I usually hear it on KQED, the local public radio station in the Bay Area.
Yeah, yes, I've heard it before.
Yeah, it's this fantastic format that I personally love, where you have a moderator and you have two panels arguing for a measure and against the measure, and there is a vote taken before the arguments. For the audience, are you for this measure or are you against this measure? With no further information, just the title.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a description. Short description. And then the two panels make their arguments, and the two panels will be either two. I think I want to say there's sometimes been three people on each panel.
Okay.
One way or another, two or more people on each panel, and they put up arguments in a semi-formal debate kind of format. And then at the end of the debate, the audience votes again. And the winner is the side that had the most change.
Right.
So, for instance, I think in this particular one, the side that was arguing against net neutrality won the debate because they went from like 23% supporting to. I got to look this up. Intelligence
to more than 23%.
I mean, like the vast majority of people supported net neutrality in the audience, just like they have in polls.
Mm-hmm.
I remember specifically that the number of people who supported preserving net neutrality stayed the same after the debate, but the number of undecideds decreased.
Oh, okay.
So I'm trying to figure out what the actual vote was. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, I'm totally rabbit holing. An argument that I heard there, an argument that I've heard in our comments on TMO, and an argument that I heard from a person that that reached out to me, an anti-net neutrality person who reached out to me. I actually thought he was a paid troll at first, but he's not. Or at least I decided that he wasn't. And that argument is that we did just fine without net neutrality for years.
Well, we did do fine without net neutrality for a while, and or at least codified net neutrality. And then we started having incidents where companies were violating the spirit of what neutrality is. And so they're partially right. We did do fine for a while without codified net neutrality.
So pre-debate, it was 60% for the motion of preserving net neutrality. Mm-hmm. And against the motion were 23%, and then undecided were 17%. And after the debate, for the motion stayed at 60%, so still a solid majority. But against the motion increased from 23% to 31%, meaning the undecideds decreased to 9%. So they technically won the debate, but, you know, while still losing popular opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's the thing. The argument that we did just fine before net neutrality rules were imposed in 2015 is an argument to preserve net neutrality rules. Because while we did not have net neutrality codified, everybody, all of the major players, all committed to and practiced the rules of net neutrality without them being codified. They were not codified until they started being broken.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason the FCC imposed net neutrality on common carriers is because those piece of crap carriers started breaking net neutrality. So if you think everything was just fine before those 2015 rules, then you should support net neutrality. And this drives me nuts because it's so illogical. It's so intellectually lazy to argue the other way around because the facts do not support it. The internet grew up and became what it is because everybody was playing by the rules of net neutrality. And the carriers could not pick and choose winners. They couldn't block. They couldn't throttle. They couldn't do the things that they wanted to do to increase their profits. They instead had to treat all data equally. And it was when they stopped doing that that the FCC stepped in. So if you think that the internet was just fine before 2015, you should support net neutrality. And this
I like this, that.
This, argument. This drives me bananas because, it, like I said, it's so intellectually lazy. It is so dishonest. And the reason editor, the two people that were arguing against net neutrality, they both made that stupid argument, and it's just so factually incorrect. Oh, it drives me freaking bananas, man.
I hadn't picked up on that. I mean, the bananas part. Yeah, and I remember on one of our ACM episodes quite a while ago.
Yeah, we've talked about this a couple times.
Yeah, but on one of the episodes, I took the time to do a quick search to see how many incidents I could find of companies blatantly going against the spirit of net neutrality.
Otherwise known as the sausage portion of the show.
Right. And it was crazy how much stuff I found where it wasn't even like, oh, well, you know, you could kind of see what they were doing and you can interpret it still as honoring net neutrality. No, it was like blatant going against net neutrality, blocking a competitor's content, trying to charge customers for specific types of content and not like movies or TV shows, but like social networks. You want to use Facebook? Okay, you have to pay your ISP an extra $5 a month.
Favoring the big ones are like favoring homegrown services, ISP owned services over services of other companies. That's one of the biggest things.
Right. An example would be an ISP like Comcast wanting people to use their own streaming as part of a cable subscription package, as opposed to using Netflix.
Right. And Ajit Pai argues that's fine as long as they're honest about it, because any ISP that does that, you can just go choose another ISP, which is great, except of course for the vast majority of people who can't go choose another ISP.
Yeah, that's not
there is no competition. There's very little competition, and there is actually very little to no competition in the majority of the United States. And this is the FCC's own freaking data. This notion that competition will solve this problem is a lie. It is an outright lie. And it drives me bananas. The anti-net neutrality site is so intellectually dishonest and lazy. Ah, man, it just drives me nuts, man. Bananas and nuts, both.
Bananas and nuts.
I'm like a salad of bananas and nuts and probably some mayonnaise or something really awful like that. So, I'm looking at you, Mom.
Yeah, I was thinking Midwest salad. It'd be bananas and nuts in lime green jello, probably with cottage cheese.
All right, so yay, dude, Senate passes net neutrality. What happened was that three Republicans, this is a pretty partisan issue, while something like 80% of the population supports net neutrality, including something like, I did look this up. There were a couple of recent polls that said 73% and 75% of Republicans, ordinary people.
Just humans.
Humans. Republican humans in the United States. So we're talking about a subset. Support net neutrality, and like 80% of all the humans in the U.S. Who were polled, of course, also supported net neutrality. In Congress, it tends to be kind of a cut and dry. Republicans are against it and Democrats are for it, in part because of lobbying and money.
So what are these Republicans that are against net neutrality going to do when they shoot it down and start getting nickel and dimed for the content that they went to see? Oh, you want to read email? Okay, well, you either use the email package that we include for you, or if you want to use, say, Gmail, well, that's an extra $5 a month per person.
You know, it really probably depends on how much of their opposition to net neutrality is principle, the principle of free enterprise, the principle of you know, competition, whether or not it actually exists, or and how much of it is based on lobbying dollars.
You know,
and I don't have the answer to that, but I do know that this shouldn't be a partisan issue, and yet is.
Well, here's the part where I get a little cynical, and I'm going to go with lobbying dollars being a big driving force here, because when I look at the people that are in Congress, most of them do not strike me as people that have a basic understanding of common technologies that we use today. Like they don't understand how streaming a movie on Netflix works. They don't understand how reading their email works. They don't understand what it means to be able to see every search result from Google. And I think if they understood these things, it would play a big role in what they choose to do. So since they don't understand, they go with the lobbying dollars.
I'll even give you a slightly more charitable interpretation of that, Jeff.
Wow. Okay.
Politicians in Congress, politicians everywhere, but you know, especially in Congress, especially at the national level, they have a lot that they have to deal with. And unfortunately, it has become a lot easier to rely on lobbyists to explain things to them because lobbyists have effectively unlimited budgets to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes politicians on both sides of the aisle on, you know, of all persuasions, they find it easier to rely on lobbyists that they trust, like, or they give them money to explain things to them. And it's not because they're necessarily evil, and it's not even because they're necessarily lazy or dishonest or anything like that. It's just like there's a lot of information to deal with, and no one can know all of the things about all the things.
That's true. No one can know all the things about all the things.
You know, and it's so easy to be against lobbying because of the corruption that comes out of it. But I mean, I suppose, what's the solution to that? That people can't talk to their elected representatives?
No,
That's no solution. Companies can't talk to their elected representatives. Well, companies shouldn't be people, but companies are stakeholders in most things. There is a company who is going to be a stakeholder in most things. So they shouldn't be allowed to talk to their elected representatives. That doesn't make any sense either. I mean, maybe you could do filters. Maybe you could dramatically increase the budgets that representatives and senators can spend on their staffs. I don't know, man. It is not a simple issue by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm certainly not suggesting that it is.
Yeah, no, I totally get. There's no easy answer there, and that means we're going to get some decisions that come out of Congress that are reasonable, and some that aren't so good.
Right. So, in the meanwhile, we had Susan Collins, a moderate Republican from Maine, mm-hmm. John Kennedy, a somewhat moderate Republican from Louisiana, and
but Lisa not Murkowski. From those Kennedys.
Maybe.
No, he makes a point to let everyone know he's not from those Kennedys.
Okay, fair enough. I've been meaning to look that up forever and keep forgetting. And then Lisa Murkowski, who is a moderate Republican out of Alaska. They all crossed party lines, and they voted with all Democrats voted for the bill. So the final passage was 52-47. Here's the deal. Doesn't matter. Still has to pass the Ajit Pai's net neutrality rules go into his rule to end net neutrality goes into effect starting on June 11th.
Mm-hmm.
That is less than a month. And this bill has to for this bill to become law, it would have to pass the House of Representatives, where it faces a significantly more uphill battle. They've got a like 20, every Democrat would have to vote for it, and then 20 Republicans would have to also vote for it. Not counting abstentions or absenteeism. And that's not likely in a body that is much more partisan, much more ideologically rigid than the Senate.
Yeah.
And then if the House passed it, then President Trump would have to pass it. And it has a very significant hurdle there, which is that President Obama was for net neutrality, and
therefore
by and large,
that means Trumpster fires against. I said that out loud, didn't I? He's against it. I said he's against it out loud. I can't believe that.
Yeah, and that has been the track record of this administration, is to undo every single thing that President Obama supported. So it really drives me nuts that this is a partisan issue. It should not be a partisan issue. It just should not be a partisan issue. The aspect of it that is partisan, which is, you know, the spirit of competition versus the spirit of government regulation, is not backed up by the facts, which is there is no competition in most of the United States.
I'm going to toss something out that just came to mind. So totally not something I've even considered until this moment. What if this is partisan because it becomes money related, meaning this creates an internet that is divided among the rich people who get the internet and the poor people who can't afford to pay for the internet because they can't afford to pay for all the individual services and all the individual accesses that they potentially face with the internet?
Well, certainly the wealthy tend to have more options when it comes to broadband choice.
Mm-hmm.
To your point.
And,
right. I mean, obviously there has been more infrastructure and more efforts at competition, more infrastructure built in markets that are more affluent because there's more money to chase. But the reality is that there are a lot of cities who award monopolies for the whole city, rich and poor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not even the case across the board.
Well, but even once you've gotten through that part of it, then it's who can afford to pay for the data? And now you're cutting out part of your population because all they can afford will be whatever completely controlled, limited access their service provider offers them, and they don't have access to the full internet because they just can't afford to pay for it.
Oh, that's I'm actually not sure what your point is. I mean, that's certainly a possibility without net neutrality rules.
Yeah, well, that's my point. Without net neutrality rules, you could create a sort of internet caste system where the wealthy can afford to have a full internet, and the poor, they cannot, and they are now at a disadvantage because they don't have unlimited access to information and content.
Fair enough. I mean, it's already the case. I mean, it's called the digital divide, and that's not only from an access standpoint, it's from a device standpoint too.
Yes, but this would make that divide wider, I think. Keep in mind, this is all coming right off the cuff because I hadn't thought about this aspect until I opened my mouth.
Yeah, to your point, Jeff, I would imagine that the digital divide will become worse without net neutrality. I would imagine that's the case. I can't cite any statistics or studies that have argued that, but it feels right. Isn't that all that's important?
Yeah, that's what really matters. And now that we've got this and we know it feels right, someone's going to come out with a study any day now. And I'll be like, see, I told you guys. Well,
right.
I'm not optimistic about net neutrality getting an extension on life.
I'm not either. If this is important to you, you should talk to your elected representative. You should send a message to your congressman, your representative, whatever party they're in. You should continue to send messages to the Senate, despite the fact that they voted on it, because it may well come back through the Senate. You should file comments with the White House.
Can you even do that anymore?
Yeah. I want to say comment. I know they turned off the petition engine, right?
Yes.
So you can no longer petition the White House, because that was super inconvenient to the White House.
Yeah. But clearly they hadn't learned the art of ignoring.
I'm not finding it. I don't know. Let's see. Send comment. White House. I mean, it certainly, there's no point in commenting to the FCC, because A, they've already passed the rules, and B, they completely disregarded the notes that they paid attention to were all the ones coming from control farm against net neutrality. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can still write or call.
Oh, great.
The White House.
If okay.
Possible, email us. This is the fastest way to get your message to President Trump. We can include a link to that in the show notes.
That sounds great.
So, yeah, your elected representative, contact them. If you care about this, contact them. And if you care about this, make it an issue that you contact candidates in the next election come November. Because it's going to end up taking legislation to block this, and I don't think it's going to happen now. June 11th is going to come around. And I also, by the way, I don't think I'd be flabbergasted if any ISP was stupid enough to violate net neutrality between June 11th and the November elections.
I would be really surprised. Also, there are several states that have been working on their own legislation that would, in essence, create net neutrality pockets. And my guess is that the big ISPs don't want to mess around with changing stuff up until they see how that plays out.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. I'm not hopeful. I'm super angry and pissed off. And I think the thing I'm angry most about is the intellectual laziness of the side arguing against net neutrality.
Yeah, it's very very disappointing.
One of the guys in Intelligence Squared who was arguing against it. First of all, the editor of Reason Magazine, I forget his name, is a very intelligent fellow, and actually I agree with him on a lot of different things, just not all things. And he was trying to argue that 10 megabits is plenty. That's broadband. 10 megabits down. Despite the fact that it's not.
Wow.
And he also kept saying 10 megabytes. He kept mixing up megabytes for megabits.
10 megabytes down would be pretty sweet.
That would be pretty sweet, right? But he was arguing that FCC says that broadband, I think, is either 25 megabits down or 35 megabits down, one of the two. And most of the U.S. doesn't have any competition at that level. And he's like, well, yeah, but there's plenty of competition at 10 megabits. So, and that's plenty. Who needs more than that?
Wow.
Yeah, since you, dude. Right? But then he was the other guy who was a former chief economist for the FCC under Tom Wheeler. He was trying to make the argument that games are less important than open heart surgery across the internet.
Okay.
And so therefore that all data is not created equal. So again, firstly, says you, and secondly, that's such a ridiculous, straw man argument.
Yeah, it's.
I just like if I was hearing arguments that made sense, my opinion would be changed.
No one has presented an argument to me that makes sense, and if someone has one, I am happy to listen to it.
Yeah, listen. If you think that an ISP should get to decide what data you receive, regardless of the data that you request, oppose net neutrality. There you go.
And let us know the logic. I'd seriously like to hear someone present a reasonable argument against net neutrality.
Well, the only reasonable argument is that competition will solve this. That actually is a reasonable argument. I mean, you can agree or disagree with it, but it at least it's a reasonable argument. The problem is there is no competition in most of the United States for broadband.
That's true.
I've got plenty of competition where I am.
Where I am, there's sort of competition. Depending on what part of Boulder you're in, determines which of the two carriers, Comcast or Xfinity. No,
so you can decide thing. Where you want to live.
Yeah.
What based upon your ISP's policies.
Yeah, CenturyLink or Xfinity. Those are your choices, and they're not...
That's plenty of competition.
Yeah, so decide which neighborhood you want to live in, since they're not available across the board.
Yeah, it's easy. It's easy, man. It's easy.
You know,
easy solution. Clearly, right, competition works.
So I've been convinced. There you go. It's all fine. We have competition. I don't need more than 10 megabits, and there's no reason for me to watch movies or play games because other people need my 10 megabits for heart surgery.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, I'm glad we could solve this.
Oh, man. I so didn't easy. Realize it was so easy. Okay.
So incredibly easy. So incredibly. All right.
I think I'm going to call Xfinity later on tonight and ask them if they can charge me more for individual services.
On June 11th, the answer to that will be yes.
That's going to be so exciting.
It's going to be so exciting. Things will be so much better. Speaking of so much better,
mm-hmm.
Ralph Nader.
All right. I shouldn't laugh, but that was actually kind of funny to me. What's up with Ralph Nader?
Does
he have like a bee in his bonnet, his panties in a bunch? Or something, because he seems like kind of uptight right now.
He does, as a matter of fact. Well, he's always uptight, which, you know, he's a man with, you know, causes. Most people with causes are uptight. I'm looking for the piece. This is it. All right. So he wrote an open letter to Apple CEO Tim Cook. And here's the thing.
Isn't that kind of passive aggressive?
Why?
Instead of just, you know, if you want to send a letter to Tim Cook, why not send a letter to Tim Cook? Well,
you send an open letter because you, of course, want to get attention to your point.
Okay, why not write an editorial instead?
He's not the first person to write an open letter.
I know. It's just, in general,
Apple has written open letters.
Yeah, I know.
Didn't Steve Jobs write an open letter?
He wrote more than one.
Well, why are you bagging on open letters, man?
It just seems kind of passive aggressive to me.
I suppose it may be.
Wait, no, I've got it. Here's what bugs me. If you're writing an open letter to a single person, just send them a letter. If you're writing an open letter that offers information for the whole public, then that's a different thing. But then maybe that shouldn't be an open letter either.
What?
I just think it's stupid.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I will fight and die for your right to think it is.
I appreciate that. That's why I love you, man.
Yep. Absolutely. So, here we go. Mr. Ralph Nader, he wrote an op-ed. I covered this. I didn't deconstruct it. I was thinking about deconstructed. I was thinking about, you know, tit for tatting and, you know, breaking down all this, everything he said and like, you know, pointing out where he was wrong or maybe where he was right. But I didn't. And instead, what I noted was that what he's asking for isn't really the issue here. Well, the issue is that he's just trying to use Apple, as so many have, on the right and left, but mostly, I think mostly on the left, have used Apple because it's a rich, super powerful, super successful corporation. And so it becomes a convenient target if you want to shine attention onto whatever cause that you're trying to leverage
Apple. Sure, against. That's something we've seen Greenpeace do in the past.
Greenpeace did it, that labor, China Labor Watch?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? China's?
I think China, that's Labor, the right Watch. Name.
Yeah, it's the New York City-based activist group that's looking at labor conditions in China. They've targeted Apple, that right-wing National Center for Public Policy Research organization, lobbyist activist group, was trying to force Apple to disclose the cost of being green, because they don't want Apple to be green. There was the group who was regularly targeting Al Gore on Apple's board of directors, trying to get him to abstain, whatever. Left and right, people use it. People use Apple because Apple, if you do complain about Apple, you're going to get attention.
Okay, so what's Nader's platform that got him to write an open letter to Tim Cook?
Well, it is the $100 billion that Apple announced for stock buybacks.
Okay.
He wants Tim Cook to suspend that decision. And then he kind of has a mixed message. On the one hand, he gives a bunch of better things that he thinks that Apple could do with that $100 billion.
Like a bouncy castle.
He didn't mention a bouncy castle.
Well, then his argument's void.
He gave five specific examples. He said for less than 2% of that $100 billion, you could give a full year's pay bonus to the 350,000 Foxconn employees who build your iPhones. So basically give bonuses to the supply chain, or at least some of the supply chain. Because Apple did announce $3 billion in stock awards to employees.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but that's not to the supply chain. So he knows, he's saying that for 2% of the $100 billion, you could give all those factory workers who are producing these products.
Give them double salary for 1 year?
Yeah, give them double salary for 1 year. He said that you could... this one's weird. This one's really, really weird. He said you can invest in research and development on ways you can diminish the effects of your company's toxic supply chain that stretches from the dangerous mines in Africa to hazardous solid waste disposal when users discard them.
Has he not been paying attention to Apple over the past decade?
Yeah, Apple does that thing that he's complaining about is the thing that Apple does better than every other company on the planet, significantly so.
Yeah.
Like the aluminum thing. You catch the Alesis thing. Did you catch that story?
That was the thing where they figured out with some other company how to make the aluminum in a far more environmentally friendly way, right?
Yeah, Rio Tinto, which is an Aussie company. Actually, I think they're Aussie British, like a Commonwealth company or something like that. And Alcoa, the American aluminum giant, came up with a method of smelting aluminum that doesn't release carbon dioxide and instead releases oxygen.
Okay.
And Apple helped finance that. Actually, that's the funny thing. Apple contributed to $144 million fund. Did I get that correct? Let me make sure. I might not have gotten that correct.
Making the sausage, grinding it up.
Yeah, I thought I had this, we did some pre-show sausage making.
No, we didn't. I mean, yeah, we did. Yeah, where are the notes from the pre-show? Didn't the interns put those on your desk for you?
Yeah, $144 million fund. Apple contributed to it. Now, Apple didn't supply all of that money. They contributed to it. We don't know exactly how much Apple did. To be honest, I bet it was a lot. But Alcoa came up with this method. But Alcoa apparently knew that they needed help. And Apple was actually looking for a solution to this particular issue. And it was Apple that reached out to Alcoa, and it turns out Alcoa has the answer, but they needed help making it commercial. So
Apple's like, okay, here's a check.
More than that, Apple turned around and brought Rio Tinto to the table. Now this is a minerals giant.
Mm-hmm.
Alcoa is also a giant in the smelting industry, in the aluminum industry, right. And so Apple brought Rio Tinto to the company and sort of helped orchestrate the entire thing. And together they formed a new company called Alesis. And Alesis is working right now on commercializing this method, so that basically trying to make it cheaper and trying to make it faster. And they're doing it all with this joint venture. Just for the record, two different governments in, I think it's Quebec and Canada, the Canadian federal government,
mm-hmm.
that I don't know if it's called, is it called the federal government in Canada?
That's a really good question. Anyway, I haven't thought about it.
Quebec would be a state government or a province government, I should say. And then, let's just call it federal.
Our neighbors. So now they're federal.
We're going to decide that it's the federal government of Canada.
So spake Brian, so shall it be.
Yeah, exactly. You're welcome, Canada. Totally welcome. Any event.
I hope they're still nice.
Two governments helped, kicked in money. Apple helped, kicked in money. Rio Tinto kicked in money. And so did Alcoa. They got this company. This is a thing that Apple did. Apple spent money and effort helping to make this happen, orchestrating, facilitating, organizing, bringing parties together and making it happen. And this is like a huge deal. This, aluminum has been smelted the same way for 100.
Yeah. And this is one place where Ralph Nader really should have done his homework, because calling Apple out for the environmental stuff feels ignorant.
Right. Apple has been organizing its supply chain to meet water treatment and water quality standards, regardless of local regulatory requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Apple has been eliminating the use of toxic chemicals throughout its supply chain. Apple is 100% renewable energy. So, yeah, for Mr. Nader to complain about, to say that Apple should be using this $100 billion for this is just...
It dilutes the value of anything else he might have in this open letter.
Yeah, there you go. That's perfect. All right, so he also said, number three, with your reported reflective bent, this would be to Mr. Cook, you can make the case for reducing some of the collateral damage from excessive iPhone use by youngsters that comes with the sedentary life of obesity, something that Apple is working on.
So once again, maybe he should have done some homework before writing the letter.
Yeah, and I'm also, I don't know, a little torn on that. Of course, you could always cut your prices for consumers, he said. So in other words, Apple should take its $100 billion and decide to become less profitable. Because, that's the thing that companies do.
Yeah, companies love doing that. Shareholders think it's the best.
Yeah, they routinely do that. And they reward those companies, too. They don't sue them for breach of fiduciary responsibility.
Right. They throw parties. Bouncy castles. Yeah. I can't even imagine the shareholder lawsuits, just how insane it would get if Apple said, so we decided that we don't want to be as profitable as we were, so we're just cutting the prices on everything, and the amount of money we'll be bringing in over the next several quarters is going to be dramatically lower. But it's okay, because Nader said.
Yeah, that's a weird one. And by the way, I'm having a... an unexpected coughing fit.
You know, this is a side effect of being a kitten wrangler. People often don't realize that when you're dealing with kittens like this, you get the fur that's flying up in the air. Sometimes to keep them calm, you have to groom them. And the hairballs, oh man, I found that I'm just yakking hairballs all the time from that.
Fair points all the way around. Now here's the best thing about Ralph Nader's little letter.
Okay.
After suggesting that Apple cut its prices, he noted, quote, in the 1960s and 70s, such profit margins as Apple's would have been an antitrust signal of possible monopolistic prices or market collusion, unquote, which might have been true in the 60s and 70s. Early absolute blanket truth, but is completely irrelevant today. And Apple clearly doesn't have a monopoly in any way, shape, manner, or form, and is clearly not colluding in the marketplace. I mean, so,
you know,
I mean, it's an idiotic thing to argue.
Yeah, that argument to me came across like if he had said, well, in the 16th century, if Apple had produced iPhones and Macs, they would have been perceived as witches and burned at the stake.
Yeah, fair enough. It's just, intellectually lazy, that argument.
Yeah.
So how I feel about that. So number five, then there are the conventional implications of a cash-rich company to consider productive new investments, raising employees' salaries and pensions, improving hiring practices and workforce training and consumer services, all of which Apple is a leader at.
Yeah, I'm sure you can find people throughout Apple that say they wish they made more money or they don't feel like they're compensated fairly for the work they do. But it seems
Apple does not pay the best in Silicon Valley. Apple salaries are not the highest here. That is an absolute fact. Mm-hmm. But Apple does have a very solid stock option.
Yeah. Okay. So they have what sounds like a nice well-rounded package. You have nice pay, not as good as some other companies, but then you have these other benefits that go along with the job that are pretty nice, including stock options in a company that has a pretty good track record of increasing its share value.
Yeah, indeed. And some people like working there, some people don't. And I mean, so, you know, it I sounds suppose like that any Apple company. Could raise its salaries. Actually, the reality is that all top employers in Silicon Valley are constantly raising their pay to be competitive. I mean, again, it's just not a very good argument. He made
is it possible kind of he's about, talking about retail?
Yeah, I suppose so. He could be. He didn't specify retail, but I don't know. Whatever. So his other point, and this is why I was calling it kind of a mixed message, because he was saying that he gives all these other things that Apple could have used some of this money for. Despite the fact that Apple is using other monies for most of those same things, right? But he also said he accused management of choosing stock buybacks rather than dividends without shareholder approval because it benefits executive bonus compensation. And what he's referring to, of course, is any kind of compensation, any kind of bonus that's predicated on Apple's stock increasing in value.
So it's a very self-centered move at the...
According to Mr. Nader.
I don't know. I'm totally happy to let everyone know I am not an expert in stock. So I don't know, but it seems to me like that's kind of a stretch to say that. I mean,
it's true to a certain extent. Stock buybacks increase the share price.
Sure, which means that everyone that has stock, their stock goes up in value.
Right. But giving shareholders $100 billion is like a one-time dividend that would put money directly in every shareholder's pocket. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that shareholders would rather have that. I think he's wrong. But part of the argument I made in my piece is that Apple did not seek shareholder approval for this share buyback program.
Mm-hmm.
But that if it did, they would get it. Activist proposals fare very poorly at Apple because shareholders tend to back management because management seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, Apple seems to be doing okay.
And shareholders back it because of that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That is definitely an important element there. And so really this whole letter was just all Ralph Nader. He also complained about the Trump tax cuts and how he has a whole paragraph dedicated to how indefensible it is to give the wealthy and corporations who have never been wealthier, including companies like Apple, a massive tax break. And how that's wrong. And that may or may not be true. If you disagree with him, you're going to probably think that he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you agree with him, you're probably going to think that he's right. But that's not Apple's problem. It's not Apple's fault.
Yeah, that's
although, true. Although Tim Cook did say that he thinks that the corporate tax reform was good. But, I mean, so this was really about Ralph Nader wanting to complain about the Trump tax cuts, and it is about him wanting to promote various progressive causes that he supports, all using Apple as a magnifying lens for those causes and his message.
So his letter was intended to be self-serving.
His letter was self-serving. I don't think it was intended to be self-serving. I don't know. Whatever. Semantics.
Yeah, regardless, it was self-serving.
Yeah. As was it Fish? Was it Fish and Ally McBeal? Would you say bygones to, like, you know, to establish that something was no longer worth talking about, regardless of whether or not it was still worth talking about? Bygones.
That's right.
Remember that? Did you watch Ally McBeal?
Occasionally, not very often. But your reference sounds familiar, so I may have seen an episode where that was a thing.
It was a repeated thing.
Then that would probably be why. I also remember the creepy dancing baby.
Yes, there was the creepy dancing baby. Good times. Oh, the 90s.
Yeah.
Oh, the 90s. Right. Okay. So that's Ralph Nader's letter. Just have a couple of minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
What was the third title? Steve, what's his name? Johnny Ives.
Yeah. Johnny Ives.
Johnny Ives, and the Hodinkee interview with him.
Right. So this was all about watches.
Yeah, Hodinkee is a high-end watch magazine. Used to be online only. They have just done two printed runs, and Johnny Ive is the cover of volume 2.
So that will sell.
Probably, yeah. It's a very glossy. I'm likely to go pick it up, even though I read the entire thing.
Yeah, because, you know, but I'm sure it's a beautiful printing.
Yeah, they appear to be doing something pretty interesting with their print run. So the stated purpose of this interview was to find out and establish that Johnny Ive is a watch guy. And I didn't really talk about it. I think I did this as the cool stuff found because the whole interview was just so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people in the watch world who hate Johnny Ive.
Why?
because they see the Apple Watch as a threat to the Swiss mechanical watch industry,
which okay.
they love, you know, the timepiece industry.
Well, am I correct in assuming that the high-end Swiss mechanical watch market will probably carry on even with Apple Watch gaining more market share, because that's a very specific group of people looking for a very specific type of product outside of the general watch buying populace?
Yeah, by and large, here's what I think is going to happen. I think that Apple has already taken a lot of share from the low end of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's going to be increasingly difficult for competitors to enter the market from the low end. But the companies that will continue to thrive are the companies that are offering high end products, you know, $10,000, $20,000 and above.
Mm-hmm.
And those devices will continue to be sold just as they continued to be sold after the quartz revolution,
mm-hmm.
after the digital revolution. And that they will survive the Apple Watch revolution. And in some ways, we're going to end up seeing I think that the Swiss companies and maybe the German companies too, the ones that are going to survive are going to be the ones that don't try to copy Apple Watch, because if they try to copy Apple Watch, they're going to get their butts kicked. But the ones that yeah. continue to focus on the beauty of mechanical watches and the mechanical functionality, and you know, ever greater complications and those sorts of things, those companies will continue just fine.
And it turns out that Johnny Ive likes watches.
And it does turn out that he likes watches. It also turns out, by the way, that Steve Jobs had nothing to do with the Apple Watch.
That's fascinating.
I long suspected that, but I didn't know it.
But he confirms.
Did we know that before? Is that come out somewhere else?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there's been speculation that the Apple Watch was the first Tim Cook only product, but I've also heard people talk about how they felt like it started before Steve left and Tim just kept that ball rolling.
Or that it had to be one of the last things Steve blessed. Well, according to this, he didn't. According to Johnny Ive, it didn't. As a matter of fact, here's the quote. I forget the fellow's name, but the Houdinki fella asked, "Did you and Steve discuss watches, and did he have an interest in them?" "No, we didn't talk about watches or us making a watch." This is Johnny Ive. "No, we didn't talk about watches or us making a watch. I don't remember him wearing one either." And so then he asked about the famous picture of Steve leaning on Mac, got a Seiko
mm-hmm.
On his wrist. You know, that was the 80s. So Houdinki asked, "Steve really didn't wear a watch." Johnny Ive said, "Correct." Like, notice the succinctness of the answers from Johnny. And then the Houdinki guy said, "So then what exactly was the genesis of the watch project? And in my mind, it felt like the last project with his fingerprints on it, but I guess that isn't the case." Johnny Ive said, "The first discussion took place in early 2012, a few months after Steve's passing. It caused us to take time, pausing to think about where we wanted to go, what trajectory we were on as a company, and what motivated us. Also, what concisely was our contribution to our users, and I think incontrovertibly, that Apple since the 1970s had made difficult to comprehend and inaccessible technology easy to understand and accessible."
Mm-hmm.
So, here's the first thing I thought about when I read that. Do you remember the Apple Watch launch? Of course, you know, we'd had all kinds of leaks.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the most leaked. I think it was probably one of the most leaked products.
Yeah, it was not a surprise. Right.
Whether or not it's true, it feels right. So that's all that counts.
That's all that really counts. Yeah.
And do you remember towards the end, the event had taken place. They'd announced the Apple Watch. They'd shown it off. Do you remember Tim Cook raising his fist?
Yeah, I do.
Do you remember he did this kind of thing? You know what I mean? Like, can you see the body language across the studio?
Yes, I can.
Like, cause it wasn't like a bro fist pump. It was a sort of self-effacing fist pump.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck me at the time. And that was when I first started. That was when I first started to suspect I was wrong that this had anything to do with Steve Jobs. That, because it was clearly like, it was this message that's saying, oh my God, we did it. We've mm-hmm. shipped a new product.
And I think it's safe to call Apple Watch a totally new product, because it was distinctly separate from everything that came before, including Steve Jobs' influence.
Apparently. Yeah. Well, indirect influence, obviously.
Of course. But it wasn't a project that he had a hand in any way, because he was not with us anymore.
Yeah, it wasn't. The first discussions took place a few months after his death. Which is interesting. So it's a really good interview. They talk about design. They talk about watches. They talk about the team that first started working on it. Mark Newsom's contribution. That's Johnny Ive's buddy.
Mm-hmm. He's a designer as well.
You know what? That picture. There's a picture. There's a picture. The title picture of Johnny Ive.
Mm-hmm.
In the Hodinkee piece.
Yeah, the full front face shot.
Yes. That picture doesn't look like Johnny Ive. It looks like the stuntman playing Johnny Ive.
You know, I think Johnny should take that as a compliment.
Absolutely. It's a great photograph. I actually think Johnny is slimmed down. Yeah,
he's probably wearing an Apple Watch.
It's a striking photograph, but nonetheless, it's a great interview. I recommend, if you have any interest in the beginning of the Apple Watch, if you're also interested in watches, you know, it's a really good interview. It's a good piece. One of the things I liked about it, I'm talking to you, John Keep. I like the style, because the style is full of, like, you know, anecdotes and you know, describing his, like, you know, describing the process of getting to the interview itself, because the point of that was all about trying to explain what the interview was about. But then he also annotates he annotates some of his own questions, trying to explain why he asked it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he annotates some of Johnny Ive's answers from the standpoint of like what he thought at the time.
Which is fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. Someone who obsesses over context.
Yeah, it's like they wrote the piece for you.
Yes.
Benjamin.
Yeah, Kleiner. And sometimes he was just providing some extra information. So anyway, yeah, great piece. Really liked it. Certainly recommend it. I know that we're over on time.
But not again. Like we were last week.
Last week was really over.
Last trick was really over, yeah. But I can fix that right now. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on and or question, shoot us an email at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
See here, our content written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth provided by Cashfly. Faces by Boom. Recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
And stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer, unless this kitten has her way.